Section 5.5. Creating Abstract Power Hierarchies Using Software. This mode of instantaneous communication must inevitably become an instrument of immense power, to be wielded for good or for evil, as it shall be properly or improperly directed. Samuel Morse, inventor of Morse code, on the telegraph. Section 5.5.1. Recreating exploitable abstract power hierarchies using a new technology. Recalling core concepts about creating abstract power from the previous chapter, to seek permission or approval from people is to tacitly give them abstract power over you. On the flip side, if you want to create and wield abstract power over a large population, simply convince them to adopt a belief system where they need your permission or approval. Once a population has adopted a belief system where they need your permission or approval, you have successfully gained abstract power and influence over them. Now combine this concept with the concepts introduced in this chapter about computer theory, namely that software represents nothing more than a belief system. Here we can begin to see how people can use software to give themselves immense abstract power by simply convincing people to adopt software applications designed as a permission-based hierarchy, such that some users tacitly need approval or permission from other people who are higher in the hierarchy and have higher permissions. To summarize the previous section, software control structure design is not an easy task. A major challenge of all software engineering is the fact that software is an abstract belief system. It does not physically exist. Like all belief systems, software is vulnerable to systemic exploitation and abuse. There is practically no limit to the number of ways that software can be exploited. Even if a software engineer could sufficiently identify the hazardous system states it needs to circumnavigate to prevent a security incident, software engineers must still figure out how to design control structures which sufficiently constrain those control signals, and they must do it using discrete mathematical logic rather than applying physical constraints, while also preserving the intended functionality and desired emergent behavior of the software. This is a profoundly difficult task. Engineers who design and build physical systems have an enormous advantage over software engineers who design abstract systems. Physical systems engineers get the benefit of being able to physically constrain unsafe or insecure control actions, and physically prevent systems from reaching hazardous states. They can build safety switches which physically prevent users from committing unsafe actions. They can build interlocks, thick walls, or heavy physical barriers. They can deter adversarial control actions by making it impossible to justify the physical cost of performing them. These are luxuries which software engineers do not have, because they do not design systems in the domain of physical reality. Instead, software engineers must use discrete mathematical logic and syntactically and semantically complex language to encode logical constraints. This is a far more difficult way to make a system secure than by using simple physical constraints. Because software engineers can't physically constrain unsafe control actions, they often design permission-based systems to logically constrain sensitive control actions. One of the most common ways that software engineers choose to secure software is to design rank-based abstract power hierarchies, where positions of high rank are granted special permission to execute sensitive control actions. Ironically, even though these abstract power hierarchies are designed ostensibly to improve security, we know from the core concepts discussed at length in the previous chapter that abstract power hierarchies have substantial systemic security flaws. This software security design methodology, which has become the predominant methodology used today, produces trust-based, permission-based, and inegalitarian abstract power hierarchies, which give disproportionate amounts of abstract power and control authority to a select few people who must be trusted not to exploit it. These software-defined abstract power hierarchies create a ruling class and a ruled class, just like legacy abstract power hierarchies, in other words, governments, do, where users are physically powerless to constrain the abstract power and control authority given to their rulers. Users must trust that actors either inside or outside the system will not find a way to abuse the abstract power and control authority given to specific positions within these hierarchies, because they're otherwise physically powerless to stop it, since they have no ability to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on systemic predators who exploit the design logic. Herein lies one of the most significant but unspoken security flaws of modern software design methodologies. It has created a new type of oppressive empire. A technocratic ruling class of computer programmers have gained control authority over billions of people's computers, giving them the capacity to exploit populations at unprecedented scale. These digital age god kings can exploit people's belief systems using software. They are actively data mining people and running constant experiments on entire populations, learning how to network target them, influence their decisions, and steer their behavior. In the hands of oppressive regimes, computer programs are dangerous because they can turn into panopticons, which give a ruling class of people unprecedented surveillance capabilities with pinpoint precision and authoritarian control over billions of people's vital digital resources. Cyberspace is nothing but a belief system, and never before have so many people come to adopt the same belief system at such a global and unified scale. Therefore, never before have so many people been so systemically vulnerable to exploitation and psychological abuse through their belief systems. Through the abstract reality of cyberspace, agrarian society can be entrapped, domesticated, farmed, and herded like cattle. Section 5.5.2. A new type of abstract dominance hierarchy over a digital age resource.
Yeah, so if you ever need info about anyone at Harvard, just ask. I have over 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses, SNS. People just submitted it. I don't know why. They trust me. Dumb fucks.
Mark Zuckerberg. In the past, abstract power hierarchies were created by writing stories using pen and parchment or encoding what we now call rules of law. Today, abstract power hierarchies can be encoded using what we now call software. This would imply that once again, agrarian society has fallen into a systemically vulnerable situation, where those who are literate with a new form of language, storytelling, and rulemaking can use it to systemically exploit entire populations. Using software, it is possible that an elite, technocratic ruling class can design abstract power hierarchies, which give themselves enormous levels of abstract power and control authority over the precious resources of entire populations, namely their bits of information. Convince a population to run a particular piece of software, and that population enters a scenario where someone wields abstract power and control authority over their resources. A software administrator's abstract power and control authority is formally codified using machine code rather than written rule of law. But from a systemic perspective, the strategy for creating abstract power and using it to build an exploitable belief system is functionally identical. As previously discussed, the strategy of a god king goes like this. Use semantically and syntactically complex language to tell lots of stories which give yourself abstract power and control authority over people's resources. In this case, their bits of information. Get people to adopt a common belief system which creates an abstract power hierarchy that places you at the top of that hierarchy. In this case, get them to use or install your software. Convince the population to trust that you will not abuse your abstract power and control authority over them to exploit them through their belief system. If the population starts to show some concern, convince them that they are secure because you have encoded logical constraints into the system. Logical constraints, which can do nothing to physically prevent you from exploiting those logical constraints in the future. Major differences between the God Kings of the past and the God Kings of the present are simply the technologies they use and the resources they control. Modern God Kings don't need slavishly obedient people anymore because they have slavishly obedient machines. Machines that are far more loyal and far less prone to uprising, at least for now. The modern technocratic elite don't need their population to farm food anymore. They just need their population to farm data. And the more a population willingly forfeits their data to the technocratic ruling class, the more that population can be experimented upon to determine causally inferable relationships and actions which drive their behavior. It's no secret that these software administrators utilize their platforms to A/B test their populations on a regular basis, to determine not just what influences the population's behavior, but what drives their behavior. In other words, neo-god kings can and do determine how to control their users based purely on what they can learn from having access to their precious bits of information. As agrarian society grows increasingly more reliant on their computers, they appear to have forgotten a lesson learned over 10,000 years of people creating abstract power hierarchies. They're systemically insecure, particularly against the people at the top of those hierarchies. The form of technology used to create abstract power hierarchies may have changed, but the function hasn't, nor have the tactics for creating and exploiting abstract power. Because people don't understand this, they appear to be oblivious to how vulnerable they are to systemic exploitation and abuse
any time they operate a computer. People are migrating to cyberspace at unprecedented scale, and software administrators with extraordinary abstract power are encouraging it and rebranding it with fun names like Metaverse. Meanwhile, nothing is protecting the population against unprecedented levels of exploitation except their trust in anonymous strangers who have control over their computers through their computer programs. As more people migrate online and grow increasingly dependent on their computers, the benefit of exploiting them through their software is only accelerating. At the same time, people continue to have no means to physically secure themselves by imposing severe physical costs on people and programs in, from, and through cyberspace. The result is an exponentially increasing BCRA for entire populations of people. The more people choose to believe in software, the more valuable software becomes as the chosen attack vector for modern systemic predators. This is happening not just at the individual level, but also on a global scale. Entire nations are now operating online, completely exposed to the whim of other nations, and utterly incapable of physically securing themselves against neo-god kings, aka software or computer network administrators. Although this systemic security problem is thousands of years old, people appear to have forgotten the lesson. All that has happened is that an older form of storytelling technology, spoken and written symbols, has been replaced by a new form of storytelling technology, state changes in a state machine. People, private institutions, public organizations, and entire nations are writing stories, convincing transnational, global-scale populations to believe things and exploit them through their belief systems. This is nothing new. This is the same abstract empire-building game with a different name. The exploitable ideology of choice is now software. Convince a population to use and believe in your software, and you can have unconstrained levels of abstract power and control authority over them that is so asymmetric it could rival that of Egyptian pharaohs. This concept is illustrated in Figure 63, Software Administrators with Abstract Power Over Digital Age Resources. Unfortunately, the general public doesn't appear to understand the complexity of computer theory enough to know that software represents an exploitable belief system. At the same time, they also don't appear to understand enough about the complexities of agrarian power dynamics to understand how vulnerable they could become to getting exploited through this belief system, much less how they can secure themselves against this form of abuse. Perhaps this is because people don't take the time to understand the difference between abstract power and physical power. They don't understand how logical constraints encoded into rule sets will not secure them against the exploitation of logic. They don't understand how demonstrably dysfunctional abstract power hierarchies are. And because of these misunderstandings, the public doesn't appear to understand how entrapped they could be, nor how they might be able to escape their entrapment. As mentioned previously, this is a recurring problem with domestication. People can lose the capacity or inclination to secure themselves by imposing severe, physically prohibitive costs on their attackers, to make it impossible to justify the physical cost, in watts, of exploiting them. Domesticated populations become inclined to believe that they can adequately defend themselves without projecting physical power. With the way the internet is currently architected, users operating in cyberspace are automatically domesticated, as the architecture necessary to project physical power to physically constrain belligerent actors is currently missing. At least it was before the invention of Bitcoin. Section 5.5.3. Software is the same abstract power projection game with a different name. Recalling a core concept from the previous section, software represents an abstract form of power and resource control authority. Computer programmers use software to construct rank-based abstract power hierarchies, which give them physically unrestricted levels of control authority over people's resources, namely their computers, the information on those computers, and all the operational functionality of computers, which is becoming increasingly substantial in the digital age. Software represents a new type of abstract power projection technology, a new way for dynasties to build their empires and reign over entire populations across multiple generations. These abstract power hierarchies have the enormous advantage of inheriting a domesticated population of users who have no capacity or inclination to use physical power to secure themselves, making them automatically predisposed to systemic exploitation and abuse at unprecedented scale. Not surprisingly for anyone who understands history, these abstract power hierarchies are becoming oppressive. People are beginning to take advantage of entire populations through their computer programs. History tells us what populations must do to escape from this type of oppression. This is a lesson that has been learned time and time again over several millennia, and modern agrarian society appears to be on the verge of learning it again. Just like agrarian populations have been trying to do for at least the last 5,000 years with other written languages, computer programmers today keep assuming that they will be able to design and codify abstract power hierarchies, which can adequately secure people against exploitation and abuse with the right combination of encoded logic. They keep trying to design complex software with increasingly complex rule sets, only to be surprised when someone inevitably finds yet another way to systemically exploit encoded logic. Somehow, people keep overlooking the fact that encoded logic, whether they're written on parchment or written in Python, are always the source of systemic exploitation and never a complete solution to it. Encoding more logic into our software doesn't stop the exploitation of logic. It just changes the way the encoded logic of our software can be exploited. Attempting to keep populations systemically secure against exploitation and abuse from software-defined abstract power hierarchies by encoding more logical constraints is a demonstrably unsuccessful strategy. Ineffective logical constraints are the source of all forms of software hacks and software systemic exploitation, not the solution to them. The same line of reasoning which applies to keeping nations secure against external invasion or internal corruption
also applies to computer programs because they are systemically identical problems. Attempting to keep software systemically secure by writing more software may be even harder and more futile than attempting to keep rules of law systemically secure against corrupt lawmakers by writing more laws. At least, when a dictator rises to power and starts to oppress people through their belief system, the population can see their oppressors. This is not the case with software. Modern oppressors can hide behind their software and obfuscate its exploitable design logic, making it even easier for a technocratic, elite ruling class to rise to the top of the abstract power hierarchy and avoid detection. For an example of this, see the discussion about proof of stake in section 5.10. Only unsophisticated oppressors allow themselves to be identifiable. The rest should understand by now that the best way to entrap people is to do it subversively using software. People don't appear to understand that a primary security hazard of cyberspace is not a lack of encoded logical constraints. A major reason why cyberspace is so systemically hazardous is because it represents the adoption of a common belief system, and all belief systems are systemically exploitable. Cyberspace is nothing more than people volunteering to assign symbolic meaning to state changes within the combined state space of a globally distributed network of state machines. Common belief systems like cyberspace can and will have their logic exploited, regardless of how that logic is encoded, especially if there's no physical penalty for doing so. In the current internet architecture, a fundamental security problem is that people have adopted a common belief system over which they have little capacity to resist exploitation, because they are literally powerless to resist it. To be systemically secure in cyberspace, digital age agrarian society must figure out a way to project physical power in, from, and through cyberspace, to impose severe physical costs on people who try to exploit them, and to physically restrict malevolent software-defined abstract power hierarchies. This would imply that to fix a fundamental and reoccurring problem with cybersecurity, the internet itself needs to be re-architected in such a way that people can impose severe physical constraints on each other, which is precisely what Bitcoin does. Section 5.5.4. The software metaphor began as a neologism for abstract power and control over computers. From the very beginning, I found the word too informal to write and often embarrassing to say. Colleagues and friends simply shrugged, no doubt regarding each utterance as a tiresome prank, or worse, another offbeat neologism. Paul Niket. If the reader is having a hard time accepting the author's assertion that software represents a form of abstract power, then consider the fact that the software metaphor first emerged as a neologism for wielding absolute power and top-down command and control authority over computers. Less than 5 years after Newman's EDVAC was delivered to the Army Ballistic Research Laboratory in 1949, computing pioneer Paul Niket coined the term software. Niket came up with the term during his experience programming the Standards Western Automatic Computer, SWAC, A stored program computer built a year after Newman's EDVAC. In his memoirs, he describes the SWAC as a mindless, subservient machine that bends to his will. Quote, I wanted nothing to do with the SWAC hardware. The machine was the mindless means for executing my programs, a necessary evil, but mostly evil. It was about at that moment I seized upon the consummate reality of what I was doing. I was writing on a coding sheet, not plugging jacks into sockets, not clipping leads onto terminal posts, not soldering wires, not bending relay contacts, not replacing vacuum tubes. What I was doing was writing on a coding sheet. It was October 1953, and I was experiencing an epiphany. Before my eyes, I saw my own markings carefully scrawled inside the printed blocks on the coding sheet. They comprised numerical words, the only vocabulary the computer could understand. My coded words were not anything like those other things, those machine things, those hardware things. I could write down numerical words, right or wrong, and after they were punched into cards and fed into the reader, the SWAC would be commanded to perform my mandated operations in exactly the sequence I had written them, right or wrong. The written codes, my written codes, had absolute power over hardware. I could erase what I had written down and write down something different. The SWC, slavishly obedient in its hardware ways, would then be commanded to do my work differently. To do different work entirely, in fact. The writing on the coding sheet was changeable. It was decided not hardware. It was, well, it was software. End quote. Here we can see how the inventor of the word software described it as a form of absolute power over slavishly obedient hardware, which would follow his commands no matter how often he changed his mind. The commands issued by a computer programmer were classified as software, and the machines slavishly obeying them were classified as hardware. Thus, since its inception, the word software has always been used as a neologism for abstract power and top-down control authority over computers. Using Niket's point of view, it's easier to understand how computer programs represent a new type of abstract power hierarchy. When a computer programmer writes software, they use a symbolic language to formally codify a rank-based hierarchical system, where they give themselves control authority over computing resources, computers which often belong to other people. In much the same way that kings or lawmakers formally codify the design of their abstract power hierarchies using rules of law, programmers formally codify the design of their abstract power hierarchies using software. Whereas kings assign themselves with abstract forms of power like rank, programmers assign themselves with abstract forms of power like admin rights. Whereas kings benefit from their control authority over their subjects' land, programmers benefit from their control authority over their subjects' computers, the information stored on those computers, and all the resources controlled by those computers. When viewing software as a way to create abstract power and codify abstract power hierarchies, this line of thinking begs a question. What physically prevents computer programmers and software administrators from becoming exploitative or abusive with their absolute power and control authority
over other people's slavishly obedient computers. The previous chapter outlined why abstract power hierarchies are systemically insecure. People, Americans especially, should be keenly aware of the threat of high-ranking individuals who are given too much abstract power and resource control authority. The citizens of all countries which have ever had to suffer the rule of an oppressive ruling class should understand the importance of being able to secure themselves against abusive and systemically exploitative people by imposing severe, real-world physical costs on anyone who would try to exploit them. If computers create new forms of property, policy, and other resources upon which entire populations depend, and if software represents a new form of abstract power and control authority over those resources, then how do populations maintain the ability to physically secure themselves in, from, and through cyberspace against computer programmers who make themselves god kings and abuse their abstract power and resource control authority? If cyberspace fundamentally represents a new kind of shared abstract belief system, what is to prevent predators from systemically exploiting us through this shared abstract belief system? The answer appears to be nothing, at least not with the current architecture of the internet. There does not appear to be anything physically preventing computer programmers from exploiting populations at massive scales through their software. This is because there is nothing empowering people to secure their precious bits of information by imposing severe physical costs on anyone who would try to systemically exploit their computer networks. That is, with one clear exception, proof-of-work systems like Bitcoin. Section 5.6. Physically resisting digital age god kings. Cyberspace. A consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts, a graphic representation of data abstracted from banks of every computer in the human system. Unthinkable complexity. William Gibson. Section 5.6.1. How did we get here? The pace of abstract thinking and cultural evolution following Niket's observations was so fast that it's easy to overlook how this situation emerged. So what follows is a short summary of 80 years of computer science. In 1953, the amount of abstract power and resource control authority wielded by computer programmers and software administrators like Niket was minimal and tightly localized. Few people knew what stored program general-purpose state machines were at that time. People didn't use these machines to manage critical infrastructure, store sensitive data, or create global-scale virtual realities, which transform how entire populations perceive objective reality. But in a span of only 6 decades, computer programmers went from encoding rudimentary symbolic Boolean logic into large and clunky electromechanical circuitry to developing what could be described as cyber empires ruled by administrators who wield unprecedented levels of physically unconstrained abstract power. Why? For little other reason than what Niket first noted about software. Software gives people absolute power over slavishly obedient machines, which directly translates into absolute power, influence, and control authority over the people who depend upon those machines. Add Niket and Columbus together, and you get today's systemic security problem. Admiral Columbus demonstrated that all it takes to get an entire population of people to do your bidding is for that population to have an exploitable belief system. To achieve the same effect as Columbus and countless other false prophets, people don't have to believe in good or God anymore. They just have to believe in Boolean logic assigned to transistor states. If you make yourself the person who programs how those transistor states change, you become the person who can control what people see and believe. In the 1940s, engineers figured out how to turn circuits into symbolic languages, which could be used to issue commands to machines. In other words, machine code. Paving the way for people like Niket to wield software as a form of abstract power and control over stored program computers. In the 1950s, engineers figured out formula translators and cleared a path towards assembling commonly reoccurring pieces of machine code together to make computer programming easier to do. This became known as assembly language. Assembly languages made the art of computer programming more accessible to people. This caused the size and complexity of computer programs to explode throughout the 1960s, until the point where NATO declared a software crisis in 1968 and asked for nations to come together to create a new field of software engineering to manage the extraordinary complexity of computer programming. In the 1970s, computer programming became its own distinct discipline known as software engineering, which became its own form of computer programming that was considered to be separate and distinct from computer science and the profession of computer engineering. These so-called software engineers began to evolve their methodologies to manage the extraordinary complexity of designing computer programs. They explored formal methodologies like discrete mathematical modeling, and they invented techniques like structured programming and modularity to make computer program design more manageable. These methodologies gave rise to the philosophy of systems thinking, which accelerated the development of new fields of engineering like systems engineering in the 1980s. Throughout the 1970s and the 1980s, computer programmers became increasingly more inclined to think of their programs as complex systems which produce complex emergent behaviors. This led to what some might describe as a software engineering renaissance. Software engineers developed an arsenal of system engineering tools which transformed the look and feel of computer programming. At the same time, developers struggled with the inherent complexity of building larger systems using assembly languages, and began to search for more effective ways to express computation. This led to a new generation of semantically and syntactically complex computer programming languages, where the most common implementation patterns used in assembly languages, for example, iteration, branching, arithmetic expressions, relational expressions, data declarations, and data assignment, became the primitive constructs for higher-level programming languages. Under pressure from NATO to create uniform, general-purpose programming languages, for example, ADA,
software engineers started inventing higher-level, general-purpose computer programming languages with very similar semantic and syntactic expressions. Consequently, a common lexicon began to emerge. Software engineers could now routinely talk about the same kind of if-then-else statements, for-while loops, cars, vars, and function calls, no matter what general-purpose language they learned. These common general-purpose languages made software engineering so easy that people no longer needed decades of experience in formal logic or computer science to program a computer. They just needed to learn the syntactic and semantic rules of higher-order computer programming languages. By the 1990s, countries like the US began to legally classify general-purpose computer programming languages as formal languages, so they could be protected under free speech laws. As previously discussed, sapiens use language to tell stories, and storytelling gives people the ability to connect neocortices and construct shared abstract realities, where some people have abstract power. Over time, the stories told by shamans turned into stories told by god kings. With this in mind, we can see that the emergence of general-purpose computer programming languages not only created a new type of literacy, it also created a new type of storytelling available to practically anyone willing to teach themselves how to communicate with computers. With any new form of storytelling comes a new way to create abstract realities where some people have abstract power. Today, people only needed to teach themselves how to write computer programs to gain immense levels of abstract power and control authority over other people's computers. In the beginning, the virtual realities and abstract power hierarchies created by computer programmers were rather small, confined to small computer networks or tribes. But then, computers found their way into single-family homes and started communicating with each other across continents. Engineers started running wires across oceans, and computers started controlling society's most critical infrastructure. Over a few short decades, the ability to program computers became the ability to control critical resources anywhere in the world from anywhere in the world. It wasn't long after the emergence of the internet that engineers started replacing signals sent across wires with signals sent across the electromagnetic spectrum. Computers shrunk from the size of a room down to the size of a pocket, and far more people started to incorporate them into their lives, growing increasingly more dependent on them. Along the evolutionary journey of computer programming, software never stopped offering a form of absolute power and control authority over machines. The abstract power and resource control authority available to computer programmers only grew as computers became more prevalent. While the population became increasingly more dependent on their computers, they became increasingly more dependent upon computer programmers. Today, the amount of abstract power and resource control authority afforded to computer programmers by the software they write has reached a level which dwarfs many nation-states. Some countries, for example, China, have recognized the source of this abstract power and moved to capture it by ensuring direct state control over software administrators. Other nations have exercised some restraint at the strategic cost of allowing some computer programmers
to become neo-god kings with formally codified abstract power hierarchies, with extraordinary and unprecedented control authority and influence over billions of people and their computers. These neo-god kings are now trying to recruit as many people into their abstract empire as possible, giving it attractive-sounding names like the Metaverse. Modern software programmers understand that the ability to program people's computers translates directly into the ability to control the data, information, and other resources which entire human populations rely upon to shape their thoughts, guide their actions, and make sense of shared objective reality. Unfortunately, people who are less familiar with computer science and power projection in agrarian society are less inclined to see the hazard this poses. Since multinational populations have become highly dependent on their computers, they are already highly dependent on the abstract power and control authority of software engineers who program them. In a very short amount of time, under the noses of the people who don't understand human metacognition, cultural evolution, and abstract power building, software appears to have emerged as the predominant form of empire building in modern agrarian society, giving software administrators the ability to rule over transnational populations through the computers they carry around in their pockets. Today, it is not even considered remarkable that a single person has physically unconstrained rank and control authority over 3 billion people's computers. But it has not yet occurred to many of them that they could now have the means to physically resist their god kings, when those god kings inevitably become oppressive. Section 5.6.2. The Metaverse is the same kind of systemic trap as the Matrix. It is still too early to know what long-term impacts computers will have on human metacognition. But one thing is already clear. Sapiens have discovered a virtual frontier which blurs the lines between abstract and objective realities even further than it was already blurred by 10,000 years of storytelling, in completely new ways that our species has never experienced before. As more people integrate symbol-generating virtual reality machines into their lives, they increase their potential to lose sight of the difference between objective reality and abstract reality, the difference between real versus imaginary things. More and more, people are entrapping themselves in semi-somnambulant dream states, where they allow strangers to control what they see, hear, and believe, feeding them with programmed illusions of freedom, serendipity, and choice. The future envisioned by the Wachowskis in the movie The Matrix appears to be coming to fruition. Modern sapiens are becoming so engrossed in the shared hallucination of cyberspace that they appear to be losing their grip on objective reality. The Matrix can be rebranded as the Metaverse, but the dynamics of entrapment and exploitation are still the same, regardless of the semantics. A growing number of people appear to be genuinely confused about the difference between the real world and the imaginary world. In this confusion, they are not grasping the difference between real and imaginary things, most notably the difference between real power and imaginary power.
Combining this confusion with a general ignorance of power dynamics in agrarian society, people appear to have no concept of the trade-off between physical power-based resource control and abstract power-based resource control. This creates an unprecedented window of opportunity for systemic predators. As young, unsuspecting, self-domesticated, and computationally illiterate people continue to migrate into the metaverse, they have no idea how vulnerable they are. This, of course, is not the first time modern agrarian society has become vulnerable to entrapment by their belief systems and consensual hallucinations. The previous chapter provided a detailed description of how sapiens developed increasingly complex applications of abstract thought, until it eventually led to the creation of abstract power hierarchies to settle intraspecies disputes, establish control authority over intraspecies resources, and achieve consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of intraspecies property. Sapiens first started using their abstract thinking skills for planning and pattern finding, but then they started using it to assign imaginary meaning to recurring patterns observed in nature through a process called symbolism. Symbolism enabled higher-order communication because it allowed sapiens to develop semantically and syntactically complex languages as a protocol for exchanging symbolically meaningful, conceptually dense, and mathematically discrete information. Armed with symbolic language, sapiens discovered the art of storytelling, a process where they can leverage people's capacity for abstract thought to create shared imaginary realities for themselves to explore together. These virtual realities were unbound by physical constraints, allowing people to explore them within the safety and comfort of their own imaginations. Fictional stories enhance sapient relationship building, information sharing, entertainment, and vicarious experience. But physical stories also lead to consensual hallucinations, where storytellers give themselves passive-aggressive access to physically unbounded levels of abstract power and control authority over the people who believe in those stories. All abstract realities created by storytellers are consensual hallucinations. The fact that the mechanism for telling these abstract stories has changed to computers doesn't change the overarching systemic dynamics of abstract power projection. People have tried valiantly to design abstract power hierarchies which keep their populations secure from exploitation and abuse using nothing more than encoded logic. But 5,000 years of written testimony prove that no combination of encoded logic, in other words, laws, has successfully prevented an abstract power hierarchy from becoming dysfunctional, exploited, vulnerable to foreign attack, or vulnerable to internal corruption. Physical power has always been necessary and essential to correct these security vulnerabilities, hence the phenomenon we call war, and the inevitable return to using physical power as the basis for settling disputes, determining control authority over resources, and achieving consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of resources. The clockwork nature of warfare is proof that abstract power hierarchies are inherently flawed. Why is physical power so useful? Because it's real, not abstract. It is therefore not endogenous to a belief system,
which can be systemically exploited by storytellers, making it immune to the threat of God Kings. Physical power works the same regardless of rank and regardless of whether people sympathize with it. Physical power is objectively true, impossible to refute, and impossible to ignore. Physical power-based control authority predates abstract power-based control authority by 4 billion years. Since the first abstract power hierarchies emerged, physical power has always served as its antithesis. Physical power has always been used to remedy the dysfunctionality of abstract power. As much as sapiens hate to admit it, sapiens depend upon the complex emergent social benefits of physical power competitions, aka warfare, to establish resource control authority the same zero-trust and egalitarian way most other pack animals do. Physical power competitions may be energy-intensive and prone to causing injury, but they are a far more systemically secure way for populations to manage resources. Abstract power hierarchies are insecure because they increase the benefit of attacking a population by creating resource-abundant and high-ranking positions with immense control authority. At the same time, abstract power hierarchies have no ability to physically constrain the control actions of attackers or oppressors. Rank and codified rule sets are all honey, but no sting. Therefore, people experience a high benefit to exploiting abstract power hierarchies, but no physical cost for doing so. The BCRA of abstract power hierarchies approaches infinity unless users figure out how to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs. But what does this have to do with software? It has everything to do with software, because software is the continuation of the same 10,000-year-old trend of people trying to create and wield abstract power over others. This isn't Sapiens' first rodeo with the exploitation and abuse of abstract power hierarchies. We know exactly how this is likely to unfold, because it has unfolded countless times before, under the same systemic conditions. We know that there is no physical limit to the amount of rank and resource control authority that software developers can wield. We can reasonably predict that eventually, populations will have to learn how to physically constrain and decentralize this growing and unimpeachable abstract power, or else they will be exploited and oppressed. Since the early days of the first God Kings, agrarian populations have routinely used physical power to constrain, dismantle, decentralize, and countervail abstract power hierarchies to secure themselves against the threat of overreaching abstract power. By continuously engaging in a global-scale physical power competition, no single abstract power hierarchy has been able to expand too far or gain too much centralized control authority over agrarian resources. We also know that domestication gives us a causally inferable, randomized experimental dataset to show how insecure animals become to systemic exploitation and abuse when they are incapable of or disinclined to project physical power. We know that abstract power hierarchies have a repeated and demonstrable strategic security risk of self-domestication. We know that it is easy to condemn the use of physical power to settle disputes
establish control over resources, or determine consensus on the state of ownership and chain of custody of property because of the energy it uses or the injury it causes. But when populations condemn the use of physical power for ideological reasons, they become systemically insecure against exploitation and abuse. We know all of this because agrarian society has repeatedly learned this lesson the hard way. Thousands of years of physical confrontation has made the strategic necessity of physical power quite clear. We know that as populations become more inclined to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on abusive, abstract power hierarchies, resource management systems become gradually less exploitative over time. In other words, abstract power hierarchies become less exploitative when people stand up and fight for their rights. Over thousands of years of warfare, the extraordinarily high levels of abstract power and resource control authority wielded by god kings were eventually reduced to kings, then to presidents and prime ministers. The centralized control of empires and monarchies were eventually decentralized into democracies, with carefully encoded checks and balances to restrict people's abstract power as much as possible. Theologies, philosophies, and ideologies increasingly favored equality and individual rights, and the encoded rule sets reflected it. This cultural evolution was gradual and filled with regression, but the trend is clear. Sapiens will find ways to utilize physical power to dismantle, decentralize, rebalance, and constrain abstract power hierarchies, because abstract power hierarchies are demonstrably and incontrovertibly untrustworthy, inegalitarian, and dysfunctional. In other words, war is the trend. If there's one thing that agrarian society has made explicitly clear, it's that they're going to fight wars to physically decentralize and constrain the abstract power of their rulers. But right now, cyberspace is missing a war-fighting protocol. This appears to be changing with the global adoption of Bitcoin. Section 5.6.3. Digital age society will inevitably learn to fight wars in, from, and through cyberspace. Here we finally arrive at the primary hypothesis of this thesis, and the reason why the author dedicated hundreds of pages to developing a new theory about power projection from which to analyze Bitcoin. The core concepts outlined in power projection theory laid the groundwork needed to understand the following insight. The power projection dynamics and cultural evolution of agrarian society, which took place over dozens of millennia, appear to be repeating themselves following the invention of computers. Except now, it appears to be happening hundreds of times faster. The emergence of cyberspace could represent something as significant to human cultural evolution as the discovery of agriculture and the corresponding abstract power hierarchies established to govern agricultural resources. Cyberspace is a globally adopted belief system that is radically transforming the way society organizes itself, in much the same way that agrarian abstract power hierarchies did. Just as agrarian society led to the formation of empires, so too does cyberspace appear to be leading to the formation of cyber empires, complete with the threat of oppressive rulers rising to the top of the hierarchy. If history repeats, then the inevitable next step for digital age society after the emergence of software, in other words, computer-generated abstract power, is the emergence of soft war, in other words, computer-generated physical power, to physically dismantle, decentralize, rebalance, and constrain it. Whereas prehistoric sapiens took tens of thousands of years of abstract thinking to develop symbolic languages and then use them to formally codify abstract power hierarchies, modern sapiens, equipped with computers, have only taken tens of years to formally codify abstract power hierarchies using symbolic languages, giving them control authority over society's digital age resources at unprecedented speed and scale. As history continues to repeat itself, these new types of software-codified abstract power hierarchies are becoming as systemically insecure and oppressive as their predecessors were. It is reasonable to believe that this will lead to population-scale exploitation, assuming it hasn't already, which would be easy to debate, which must inevitably be resolved the same way it always has been resolved, using real-world physical power competition to physically constrain and decentralize the emerging tyrannical, technocratic ruling classes and their oppressive empires. In other words, a new form of digital abstract power is likely to bring a new form of digital warfare to physically decentralize and constrain it, just as warfare has always been used as a mechanism to physically decentralize and constrain abstract power hierarchies. See section 4.9 for a detailed explanation of this. The author hypothesizes that humanity is going to become so tired of being systemically exploited at unprecedented scales through their computer networks by an elite, tyrannical, and technocratic ruling class that they are going to invent a new form of digital warfare and use it to fight for zero trust, permissionless, and egalitarian access to cyberspace and its associated resources. Using some type of new digital age physical power projection tactic, people will be empowered to compete for egalitarian access to and control over bits of information passed over cyberspace. This new form of electro-cyber warfighting will allow the population to keep itself systemically secure against exploitation from an abusive ruling class by giving them the ability to impose unlimited amounts of severe physical costs on their oppressors. An open-source electro-cyber warfighting protocol would allow people to keep themselves physically secure in cyberspace, in other words, virtual reality, using the same technique they already use to keep themselves physically secure in objective reality, by making it impossible to justify the physical cost, in watts, of attacking them. An illustration of this hypothesis is shown in Figure 64, a repeating pattern of human power projection tactics. Without this new type of warfighting protocol, entire populations, including entire nations, will become increasingly vulnerable to wide-scale systemic exploitation and abuse via cyberspace. Just as populations rely upon physical power competitions as a protocol to physically constrain abstract power and control authority over agrarian resources, a primary hypothesis of this thesis is that all populations, including and especially nation-states, are going to need an equivalent protocol to physically constrain the abstract power and resource control authority wielded by those who write and administer computer programs. Without adopting a soft war protocol, entire nations could be vulnerable to becoming subservient to an elite, technocratic ruling class, which could emerge either domestically or from a foreign power. People are going to need a physical cybersecurity protocol designed to provide society with the same complex emergent benefits as warfare. The goal of this so-called cyber warfighting protocol would be to give populations the ability to secure themselves using physical constraints rather than, demonstrably unsuccessful, logical constraints. By literally empowering people to impose severe physical costs on people and programs in, from, and through cyberspace, agrarian society will be able to once again physically constrain people who abuse their imaginary power and control authority. At the same time, this would likely unlock a zero-trust, permissionless, egalitarian method of physical power projection in cyberspace that could transform the profession of cybersecurity and possibly even change the foundational architecture of the internet. Section 5.7. Projecting Physical Power in, From, and Through Cyberspace. Power is almost everything. It doesn't matter what you think is right. It matters what you can demonstrate and enforce is right. Lynn Alden. Section 5.7.1. There's two ways to constrain software, logically or physically. Now that we have established a thorough conceptual understanding of power projection tactics in nature, human society, and cyberspace, we can finally begin to analyze the national strategic implications of Bitcoin from a different point of view. Not merely as monetary technology, but as physical power projection technology and a new form of digital age electro-cyber warfare. So far, the author has focused on providing an exhaustive explanation for why human populations use physical power competitions, in other words, wars, to settle disputes, determine control authority over resources, establish consensus on the legitimate state of ownership and chain of custody of property, physically constrain abstract power hierarchies, preserve international trade routes, and secure themselves against systemic exploitation and abuse. This lengthy discussion was designed to help the reader understand why society would even want to adopt a digital warfighting protocol in the first place, which, in the author's opinion, is a much harder and more important question to answer than how it could be done. Perhaps the reason why people don't understand the value of Bitcoin is because they don't understand why people would want to project power and impose severe physical costs on others in, from, and through cyberspace. Now that we have answered the why, the next question to ask is how it could be done. To answer this question, we can begin by asking ourselves to consider what a global-scale cyber war might look like. Would it even be possible to wield and project physical power, a real-world thing, in, from, and through cyberspace, an abstract domain? How could someone impose physical, aka non-virtual, costs virtually? The key to understanding how this could be done is to return to the first principles of computer theory. First, we can recall von Neumann's early observation about stored program state mechanisms. Quote, It is easy to see by formal logical methods that there exist codes that are, in abstracto, adequate to control and cause the execution of any sequence of operations which are individually available in the machine, and which are, in their entirety, conceivable by the program planner. End quote. In this quote, von Neumann highlights that software has two primary constraints: the physical limits of the state machine and the imagination of the computer programmer. First, the software running on a computer can be constrained using any design logic conceivable by the program planner, logic which we have established is routinely dysfunctional and incapable of securing software against the systemic exploitation of its own logic. Alternatively, a computer program can be constrained by physically constraining the underlying state mechanism running the program. This is illustrated in Figure 65, illustration of two ways to constrain a computer program. This observation has subtle but important implications for cybersecurity, because it offers insight about a potential way to improve cybersecurity by physically constraining computers, rather than continuing to attempt to encode logical constraints into software, a practice that is clearly ineffective, hence the current hacking epidemic. To make cyberspace more secure, it is possible to physically constrain the underlying computers connected to the internet. This would imply that what cyberspace is missing is an open-source internet protocol and supporting infrastructure needed to physically constrain computers. By creating an open-source protocol which empowers people to physically restrict computers via the internet, society would gain an unprecedented physical cybersecurity capability, which they could use to physically secure themselves against each other in, from, and through cyberspace. Section 5.7.2. Not being able to physically constrain computers is a major systemic security vulnerability. So far, we've established that software system security vulnerabilities are derived from insufficient constraints on control signals, which can be exploited in such a way that it puts software into insecure or hazardous states. Software security engineers have a major disadvantage in their ability to constrain the control actions executed by computer programs in comparison to physical control actions executed by people or machines. The fundamental challenge is that software engineers must use discrete mathematical logic to constrain software control actions, because it is otherwise impossible to physically constrain an undesired command signal without physically constraining the underlying state mechanism. Herein lies a key insight that remarkably few computer theorists seem to understand. The inability to apply physical constraints on computers is a major systemic security vulnerability. Not having a mechanism to apply physical constraints on computers forces software engineers to design trust-based abstract power hierarchies, where sensitive control actions are logically constrained by giving the authority to execute them to a select few users of high rank, for example, system admins, which are usually themselves. This consolidates or centralizes software administrative permissions to select user accounts that can be systemically exploited. Software engineers must then devise ways to prevent outsiders from accessing and exploiting these special administrative permissions. At the same time, The software's legitimate administrators and engineers must be trusted not to exploit their self-encoded abstract power and control authority over the system. Because these control structure designs rely on trusting people not to execute unsafe control actions rather than physically constraining them, they are systemically insecure. It turns out that trusting a small, centralized group of software engineers and administrators not to exploit their abstract power is a highly ineffective security strategy backed by thousands of years of testimony. The BCRA of a trust-based abstract power hierarchy approaches infinity as the benefit to attacking or exploiting it increases. Meanwhile, users must accept the risks posed by a perpetually increasing BCRA because they have no alternative way to physically constrain unsafe control signals or impose severe physical costs on people who exploit their special permissions over the system. Section 5.7.3. A protocol which physically constrains computers would look like a very inefficient program. To remedy this glaring systemic security vulnerability in our current approach to cybersecurity, we need a way to physically constrain computers. Using physical constraints to improve cybersecurity is not a new concept. For example, a common cybersecurity strategy in many organizations is to physically remove hardware, for example, USB ports, in the computers to physically prevent belligerent actors from stealing sensitive data from a given computer network, or uploading malware to it. U.S. military personnel physically secure their encryption keys by carrying them on specially designed Common Access Cards, CACs, in their wallets. The same principle also applies to strategies like air-gapped networks. An air gap represents a real-world physical constraint applied to the underlying state mechanisms of a given computer network. It should be noted, however, that these are examples of self-imposed physical constraints that are not transferable in, from, and through cyberspace. If someone were to develop a technique for applying physical constraints to other people's computer programs in, from, and through cyberspace, that would represent a remarkable new capability in cybersecurity. It would be especially noteworthy if this capability manifested itself as a globally adoptable open-source protocol that utilized an existing infrastructure, for example, the Global Electronic Power Grid, to apply these physical constraints to computers connected to the internet. With these concepts in mind, the rest of this chapter can be summarized with the following. It is theoretically possible to create computer programs that are inherently secure, because it's either physically impossible or too physically difficult to put them into a hazardous state, simply by intentionally applying physical constraints to the underlying state mechanisms running the software. It is also theoretically possible to design computer protocols which can apply real-world physical constraints to other people's computer programs in, from, and through cyberspace. Incidentally, this protocol already exists, and it already has a name. It's called Proof of Work. If an open-source protocol were invented that allowed people to physically constrain or chain down the underlying state mechanisms connected to the internet, that would likely become a valuable cybersecurity protocol. If the protocol were globally adoptable in a zero-trust, permissionless, and egalitarian way, it could become so valuable that it would represent a national strategic priority to adopt it. There's a strategic imperative for nation states to be on the lookout for the development of any kind of open source physical power projection protocol, which empowers people to physically constrain or chain down other people's computer programs in, from, and through cyberspace. A protocol like this would be of national strategic significance because it would represent the discovery of a globally adopted physical security protocol for cyberspace and an unprecedented new cybersecurity capability. This concept is illustrated in Figure 66, Chain Down Design Concept for Physically Constraining Computers. Knowing that such a protocol is theoretically possible, the next question becomes, what would such a system look like? What kind of physical constraints would the system impose to chain down computers, and how would it work? What kind of supporting infrastructure would this system require to apply these physical restrictions? One way to physically constrain computers via cyberspace is by filtering all incoming control signals through a special kind of state mechanism with a physically constrained state space that has deliberately difficult to change states. In other words, to physically constrain other people's computers via cyberspace, create a computer that is intentionally costly, in terms of watts, to operate, and then require other people's software to run it. This concept is illustrated in Figure 67, Security Protocol Design Concept of a Deliberately Inefficient State Mechanism. Herein lies another key insight that many people, including but especially software engineers and computer scientists, overlook. A special type of computer that is highly inefficient, with intentionally difficult to change states, would have counterintuitively beneficial emergent properties for cybersecurity. By deliberately designing a computer to be inefficient, in other words, intentionally physically costly to operate, and then designing software logic requiring other people to use it, it would be possible to apply physical restrictions to other people's computers in, from, and through cyberspace. There would be extraordinary strategic benefits to deliberately creating an inefficient state mechanism, which takes an excess quantity of physical resources, for example, electricity, to operate, as those thermodynamic restrictions would double as a way to physically constrain sensitive software control actions, rather than logically constraining them. The key insight that seems to be overlooked by computer theorists is that a highly inefficient computer to which everyone has zero trust and egalitarian access would likely be very beneficial for cybersecurity purposes. Based on this insight, we can see that an open source, globally adopted physical security system for cyberspace would likely manifest itself as something which, on the surface, appears to be extraordinarily inefficient. This inefficiency would not be a bug, but rather a feature. In fact, it would be the primary value-delivered function of a system which allows people and their programs to apply physical constraints on other people and programs in, from, and through cyberspace. The inefficiency of the system would represent the real-world physical costs imposed by the system onto people in the virtual domain. Adding these thoughts together, the author offers the following insight. To recognize an unprecedented new cybersecurity capability that could transform how people secure digital resources, we should look for the emergence of open source protocols which, to the untrained and uninformed eye, would appear to be highly computationally inefficient. This inefficiency would not be a bug that needs to be corrected. It would be a very important and highly noteworthy feature that is essential for physically securing software. With this in mind, we turn our attention to cost function protocols and the invention of proof of work. Section 5.7.4, Physical Cost Function Protocols, aka Proof of Work Protocols, are not well understood. The author challenges the reader to think of an open source protocol as infamous for its computational inefficiency as Bitcoin. Bitcoin is constantly criticized for how much power is consumed by the computers which run it. What is not understood is why computational inefficiency is an incredibly useful cybersecurity feature, not a bug. In other words, Bitcoin's computational inefficiency is its primary value delivered function. It's the thing that has been missing in cybersecurity that is needed to physically constrain belligerent actors, rather than continue to fail to logically constrain them. The author hypothesizes that people don't understand the security benefits of Bitcoin's inefficiency because they don't understand how physical security works, nor the enormous systemic security benefits gained by projecting physical power, aka watts, to impose severe physical costs on attackers in order to raise one's cost of attack and thus lower one's BCRA. Without this background, it's difficult to understand why open-source computer programs, which literally empower people to do this via cyberspace, may represent an unprecedented and remarkable cybersecurity capability, which could change the way people design their software, and even potentially transform the underlying architecture of the internet. This lack of understanding of how power projection works is why the author has outlined the following first principles approach to understanding the Bitcoin protocol, not as a monetary system, but as a physical security system, which utilizes a computationally inefficient state mechanism to give people the ability to impose real-world physically prohibitive costs on other people in, from, and through cyberspace. To build a first principles foundational understanding of Bitcoin as a security system, it is necessary to develop a thorough understanding of the security design concept colloquially known as proof of work, or what the author alternatively calls proof of power. Section 5.7.5, to eliminate superfluous control signals, aka spam, make control signals superfluously costly. Today, most computer programs send control signals across cyberspace at practically no marginal cost. The lack of marginal cost is a byproduct of engineers designing highly efficient computers. Unfortunately, cheap computing is a feature that is commonly exploited by belligerent actors. For example, it's possible to attack computer networks by sending millions of superfluous control signals, for example, service requests, to overwhelm a target network's bandwidth. Ironically, the reason why these control signals are superfluous is because the costs associated with sending them aren't superfluous. Because computers don't add superfluous costs, like additional electricity, to sending control signals, it is trivial for belligerent actors to flood target networks with superfluous control signals. This type of systemic exploitation is commonly known as a denial of service, DOS, attack. The near-zero marginal cost of using efficient computers to send superfluous control signals across the internet is what enables practically all email spam, comment spam, bot farms, troll farms, and many other popular exploitation tactics possible. Because there's minimal physical cost associated with these activities, there's practically no physical costs imposed on those who systemically exploit these control signals. In other words, the BCRA of this type of attack is high because cost of attack is practically zero. Section 5.7.6, searching for the best way to make control signals superfluously costly to execute. For decades, software engineers have been experimenting with different ways to improve cybersecurity by creating control structure designs which physically constrain unsafe control signals by physically constraining underlying computers. There are many different ways that this can be done, each with their own trade-offs. A popular way to physically constrain unsafe control signals is by physically constraining access to the computers which send those signals. As previously discussed, this can be done via physical computer access control points or air gaps. For example, the U.S. military keeps top-secret intelligence information secure against data leaks by physically restricting access to the computers which store that information, using air-gapped intranets, where each computer in the network is locked within a specially designed, sensitive, compartmented information facility, SCIF. This air-gapped intranet with physically constrained access control points is known as the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communication System, JWICS. Physically constraining computers in this way has major trade-offs, though. First, the functionality and utility of these air-gapped intranets are severely restricted because they are difficult to access and they cannot easily communicate with other computer networks. Second, they are still systemically insecure because they are trust-based, inegalitarian, permission-based systems within a centralized abstract power hierarchy. Thus, they're still vulnerable to systemic exploitation. People must rely on third parties with abstract power and control authority, in other words, administrative privileges, over these networks to gain and maintain access, and that access can be revoked at any time. Additionally, once granted access to these air-gapped networks, people still have to be trusted not to exploit their access. There's little physically preventing them from leaking the sensitive information contained within JWICS networks to other networks. As many highly publicized leaks of JWICS data would suggest, these types of trust-based security systems are systemically insecure. Fortunately, there appears to be other ways to physically constrain unsafe software control signals that don't suffer from these negative trade-offs. Software engineers have been investigating different ways to do this for at least 3 decades. Throughout the late 90s and early 2000s, software engineers began to propose different kinds of software protocols which could prevent an adversary from gaining access to online resources by simply making it superfluously costly for them to do so. The first software engineers to publish a paper about the security concept were Cynthia Dwork and Moni Naur. In their paper, Pricing via Processing or Combating Junk Mail, Dworck and Naur state the following, quote, "We present a computational technique for controlling access to a shared resource. The main idea is to require a user to compute a moderately hard but not intractable function in order to gain access to the resource, thus preventing frivolous use. To this end, we suggest several pricing functions." End quote. This paper was the first to offer a subtle but profound cybersecurity concept. To secure access to resources, simply decrease the benefit-to-cost ratio of accessing those resources by increasing the cost of accessing them. In other words, Dworck and Naur's idea was to utilize the primordial economic dynamics discussed at length throughout Chapter 3. To keep online resources secure against DOS attacks, simply increase the computational cost, in other words, increase the cost of attack, of executing certain control actions to decrease the BCRA of executing those control actions. Dworck and Naur offered several ideas for candidate pricing functions, to include hash functions, which could be used as the mechanism to add superfluous costs. But they concluded that, quote, "There is no theory of moderately hard functions. The most obvious theoretical open question is to develop such a theory." End quote. Here we see the emergence of the idea that software can be secured using the same primordial economic dynamics that life has been using for 4 billion years. Simply decrease the BCRA of attacking or exploiting software, rather than trying to write exploitable logic. All that appeared to be missing was for someone to develop the necessary theories of how it could work, why it could work, and specifically, what cost function algorithms should be used. By 1999, Dworck and Naur's idea for securing online resources by making computers solve moderately hard pricing functions was formally named proof of work. Multiple computer scientists, including Marcus Jacobson and Ari Jules, conceived of potential use cases and designs of proof of work protocols. The concept was simple. A computer can constrain the control signals sent by belligerent computers by superfluously increasing the computational cost of sending those control signals. In other words, software can physically constrain another computer by making it computationally inefficient for them to execute certain functions or send specific commands. As previously discussed, there is a clear value in computational inefficiency, and the strategy is quite simple. To physically constrain a bad guy's computer, create a computer program that is deliberately inefficient to run, and then force the bad guy to run it. It's important for the reader to note that, like all software specifications, semantic specifications of software design concepts like proof of work, are completely arbitrary. See section 5.4 for a more thorough breakdown of this concept. When proof of work was formally introduced into scientific literature, it was arbitrarily called a bread pudding protocol. Jacobson and Jules explained the name as follows, quote, "Bread pudding is a dish that originated with the purpose of reusing bread that had gone stale. In the same spirit, we define a bread pudding protocol to be a proof of work such that the computational effort invested into the proof may also be harvested to achieve a separate, useful, and verifiably correct information." End quote. In the very same year, the same author gave the same proof-of-work protocol a different name, a client puzzle system. The takeaway? What people call their proof-of-work software doesn't matter, because it can be, and has been, called practically anything. What matters is not the name. What matters is how it works, why it works, and most importantly, why people would want to use it. Interestingly, 2 years prior to the release of these formally published academic papers about how proof-of-work protocols could work, a software engineer named Adam Back privately released his own version of an operational proof-of-work protocol concept he named Hashcash. Despite having a different name, the intent of the protocol was the same: to secure software against threats like DOS attacks by adding superfluous costs to sending unwanted control signals, thus decreasing the benefit-to-cost ratio of sending unwanted control signals. Just like his peers did, Back asserted that this type of protocol could function as a mechanism to throttle systemic abuse of internet resources. Section 5.7.7. Proof-of-work protocols are literally proof-of-power protocols. It is imperative for the reader not to overlook the fact that proof-of-work protocols very specifically create real-world physical costs that can be measured in watts. These protocols are computationally inefficient, not just because of how many calculations they require, but because of how many watts must be consumed to make those calculations. By using a deliberately inefficient protocol like this, a person or program applies a real-world physical cost on the execution of control signals sent by other people or programs operating on different computers. To emphasize this point, the author will interchangeably use the term physical cost function instead of pricing function, and proof of power or bit power instead of proof of work, where the term physical cost refers to the real-world physical deficit of electric power, aka watts, required to generate a proof of power. By increasing the physical cost, aka watts, required to execute a command action or send a control signal, Back showed how it was possible to increase the marginal cost of exploiting certain control signals, exactly as envisioned by Dworkin and Naur. This can be done by utilizing a two-step process shown in Figure 68, visualization of the two-step process of Adam Back's physical cost function protocol. The first step is to create an algorithm that is so computationally difficult to solve that it imposes excess physical cost, aka watts, on computers attempting to solve it. This algorithm effectively creates a vacuum of electric power that must be filled for the physical cost function to generate the proof of power. Finding the right hashing algorithm to achieve this first step was a challenge that took years to resolve. Many candidates for physical cost functions were discussed throughout the 90s, but Back's physical cost function became popular because the algorithm he designed doesn't appear to provide an advantage to any particular method for solving it. It utilizes a lottery-style pick-the-winning-number technique, where computers must repeatedly guess random numbers until they pick the winning number. A major advantage of this type of lottery system is that it appears to be perfectly impartial and fair. Back's algorithm is equally and uniformly difficult for everyone to solve. On a per-guess basis,
nobody appears to be able to gain an upper hand on solving Back's algorithm, no matter who they are or what kind of guessing strategy they use. One single guess has equal odds of being correct as any other guess, and there's no apparent way to game or exploit the algorithm to give somebody an unfair guessing advantage. Consequently, the most effective way to solve Back's algorithm is by using a brute force guessing technique, where computers must make as many random guesses as they can as quickly as possible. The second step of Back's cost function protocol is to issue an abstract proof or receipt to the entity which successfully solves the hashing algorithm. This allows the bearer of the proof or receipt to verify that they incurred an excess physical cost, as measured in watts, for solving the algorithm. Back arbitrarily called this abstract receipt a proof of work, based off the precedent set in formal academic literature by Jacobson and Jules, and their bread pudding protocol, where proof refers to a bare asset, for example, a receipt, stamp, or token, and work refers to the expenditure incurred to solve the hashing algorithm. Something that is vitally important for the reader to understand about proofs of work is that the term proof of work represents an abstraction for a real-world physical phenomenon, power, in other words, watts. The proof, or token, or receipt that is used to verify the power expenditure is abstract, but the power expenditure is a real-world physical phenomenon that is directly measurable in watts. The reason why this is important will be discussed in much further detail in section 5.9, but the main takeaway for now is that a proof of work is an abstract way of describing a real-world physical thing, which means that proofs of work inherit all the physical and systemic properties of real-world physical power, which are physically impossible for other types of computing systems to replicate, as discussed in section 5.9. This is why it is physically impossible for proof-of-stake protocols to replicate the same systemic security benefits of proof-of-work systems. As shown in Figure 68, Back's physical cost function protocol can be visualized as a black box with a single input and a single output. The input is a vacuum of real-world physical power, aka watts, which must be filled to solve the protocol's hashing algorithm. The output is the proof of power receipt, issued to prove that a real-world physical power expenditure was incurred to solve the algorithm. The reader may be asking, what's the point of a computer program which intentionally creates a vacuum of physical power that must be filled, and then issues a receipt to the entity which fills it? The answer is worth repeating. This activity imposes a physical cost on other people in, from, and through cyberspace. With the invention of physical cost function protocols, it becomes possible to impose real-world physical costs on others by simply demanding they present proofs of power. This is an extraordinarily simple but effective cybersecurity capability that has been notably missing from the current architecture of the internet. This is where the core concepts of power projection theory become so important to understand. Back's hashcash could represent the first earnest attempt at building a physical cost of attack function, or cost of attack function. Proof of physical power expenditure represents proof of real-world physical cost, which means proof of high cost of attack. Back's protocol showed how it was feasible to physically constrain the execution of unwanted signals by simply increasing control signal cost of attack. By increasing the physical cost of sending unwanted control signals, physical cost function protocols increase the physical cost of exploiting or abusing those control signals. People gain the ability to improve systemic security and solve the survivor's dilemma by projecting physical power. The more people increase the physical cost of sending control signals, not just spam, as originally envisioned by Dvorak and Naur, but any type of unsafe or unwanted control signal, the more its cost of attack increases, and the lower its BCRA becomes. Control signals with lower BCRA are intrinsically more secure against systemic exploitation or abuse, because they're more physically expensive to exploit. This concept is illustrated in Figure 69, illustration of two different types of control signals. The arrow on the left represents a typical low-cost control signal sent by a computer program across cyberspace at near-zero physical or marginal cost. The arrow on the right represents a high-cost control signal, which has been physically constrained through the addition of proof of power. By stamping a control signal with proof of power, the receiving computer of that control signal can verify excess physical cost, aka watts, was imposed on the user which sent this control signal, giving it a higher cost of attack and lower BCRA, thus making it more strategically secure against exploitation and abuse than an ordinary low-cost control signal with a high BCRA. The ability to increase control signal cost of attack gives software security engineers a capability they didn't previously have, the ability to use software to physically, not just logically, constrain sensitive control signals. It also gives users an ability they didn't have before, too, the ability to project real-world physical power against other people and programs in, from, and through cyberspace. With the invention of physical cost functions, all one needs to do to impose physically prohibitive costs on other computers, programs, and computer programmers is to simply refuse to accept control signals unless they present proof of power. Thanks to physical cost function protocols, software engineers can secure computer programs in the same way that animals project power to secure themselves in nature, and sapiens project power to secure themselves in society. By simply raising the cost of attack, and thus lowering the BCRA of control signals, it is theoretically possible to dramatically improve the security of software against systemic exploitation and abuse by any belligerent actor in novel ways that were previously not considered possible. Thus, physical cost functions represent a noteworthy contribution to the field of cybersecurity that people could be overlooking just because they arbitrarily adopted the habit of calling it a monetary protocol. Another interesting observation about physical cost function protocols is that they appear to be the continuation of a 4-billion-year-old trend of organisms developing increasingly clever power projection tactics to keep themselves secure against predators by continually increasing their capacity to impose physical costs on them. Using physical cost functions, sapiens appear to have discovered a way to project power by directing energy in such a way that it enables them to impose severe, physically prohibitive costs on their neighbors via cyberspace. It should be noted that because physical cost functions passively utilize an electric form of physical power, rather than a kinetic form of physical power, they represent a non-lethal form of global-scale power projection, making them potentially disruptive to traditional methods of agrarian warfighting. More on this later. A globally adopted proof-of-power protocol could mean that agrarian society has figured out a way to impose severe physical costs on entire populations of people, such as nations abusing their specially encoded administrative privileges, but in a way that is incapable of causing injury. Therefore, not only do physical cost function protocols likely represent a noteworthy contribution to the field of cybersecurity, but they could also one day be considered to be a noteworthy contribution to the field of security in general, particularly national security. Physical cost functions literally empower people to physically secure their digital age resources and policies against exploitation and foreign attack without physically injuring anyone or causing practically any form of physical pain or discomfort. This is a remarkable capability, considering how traditional physical security and legacy physical power competitions tend to be highly destructive and fratricidal.